Welcome to another episode of our NCLEX review series. In this podcast, we continue to bring you valuable materials to help you prepare for your exam. Enjoy.
Then there's the electromyogram. And the electromyogram is a very interesting test. They actually put one little probe right here, right by your shoulder, and another little probe right down here by your wrist, and then they send a current from one probe to the other, and then they time how fast it gets there. And they can tell from that timing, you know, whether you're neurologically intact or not, at least you've got good conduction or not. The fourth test is the electroencephalogram. And the electroencephalogram is when they put little patches to your head and they wire you up to a machine and the machine records the electrical activity of your brain. That's non-invasive. And the only thing you need to tell your patients is that afterwards they just need to wash their hair real good because it's got gel all over it. All right, couple of invasive neurotests. The lumbar puncture is one. Now, we do the lumbar puncture for what? To obtain cerebrospinal fluid so we can analyze it, yes? We also do an angiogram, and then we're actually injecting, utilizing a dye for this one, and a myelogram. Okay, so actually, let's go back. With the lumbar puncture, what is your responsibility? Your responsibility is to make sure that the patient is lying in the appropriate position because you want to what? Open up the spine so that the doctor can go in the right to the right cavity, okay? Your responsibility also is to, according to NCLEX, now remember, right now, has anyone here assisted with a lumbar puncture lately? Oh my gosh, it's incredible, because you actually have a package, okay? You just open the package up, and everything is labeled for you. Tube 1, tube 2, tube 3, tube 4. Everything is set out in such a systematic way that you would have to be an absolute idiot to mess up. I mean, even the doctor can do it without messing up. You got it. I'm so happy. Yeah. So you have to, you know, it really... But what NCLEX wants you to know is that you've got to know you have to label each tube as it comes out, right? It's tube 1, tube 2, tube 3, tube 4, all right? But I'm here to tell you that if you work with the new lumbar puncture sets, it's a total no-brainer. It really is. It's fantastic, okay? For NCLEX purposes, you need to be able to label it, and you want to observe also what? The color of the fluid that comes out. You know, it should be clear. Okay, and it should not have any cloudiness or blood to it. The first tube that comes out, you may have a little bit of blood, but that's from the trauma of the insertion of the lumbar puncture needle. The other thing you've got to know is that the cerebrospinal fluid is high in what? It's high in glucose, correct? There should be zero protein in your cerebrospinal fluid, zero. It should be high in glucose. So if, therefore, you have a patient who comes in and was in perhaps a head-on collision, or maybe had he fell on his head or something, and he starts, clear fluid starts coming out of his nose or out of his ears, what should you do? You should test it for glucose, and if it's positive, that means what? You call the doctor, because it means he's got some disruption to the integrity of his central nervous system, particularly his brain and spinal cord, okay? All right. Neurological diseases. I got more animals up. This is a dog. Okay, let's talk about Bell's palsy. And you see how his face is all pushed onto one side? Well, Bell's palsy is a facial nerve disorder of cranial nerve number 7. What happens with Bell's palsy is that you can be flaccid on one side, there's some drooling, there's a droopy mouth, there's a pain behind the ear, and you cannot shut that eye. Okay. It mimics a stroke. Now, I'm going to tell you a very sad story. Right before I came up here, a 34-year-old black woman came to the ER, and she had trouble talking. She had been this way for 3 months. 3 months ago, she had gone to a doc in the box, and she had complained of this unilateral facial drooping. Okay, they took her blood pressure and they told her that it was sky high. They didn't tell her what it was, but they told her it was sky high and that she should lay down. So she did, she laid down in the clinic, and then they sent her home. And she said that by the time she got home, she could not get out of the car. She couldn't stand. She fell out of the car when she tried to get out of the car. She fell out of the car. So she followed up. Doc in a box said to her to follow up. So she followed up with another doctor and told that doctor, actually her husband told the doctor, what the doc in the box, the clinic, had said. So that doctor proceeded to follow along those lines because they had been told it was Bell's palsy. So he proceeded to treat the patient for Bell's palsy. Okay, saying you will get better. It'll take a few months, and it does with Bell's palsy. Takes a few months, but it will resolve. So kept telling this patient it would resolve. Well, 2 months after, nothing resolved and everything like that. Now her right arm becomes flaccid. Okay? So now all of a sudden this right arm is flaccid, and all of a sudden she can't feel anything in this right arm. And then the next thing you know, she can't speak very clearly. All this time, she has not been on the single antihypertensive medication. She comes into the ER. Her blood pressure was 280 over 140. We sent her, obviously, for all the tests. She had had a stroke. Bell's palsy can mimic CVA. Okay? CVA can mimic Bell's palsy. What's the treatment? Well, the treatment that this doctor put her on was basically eye drops because, you know, with Bell's palsy, you can't shut the eye. Eye drops, told her to follow up with a doctor, gave her steroids to take. She was taking like 20 prednisone a day, gave her analgesics, you know, for the discomfort, lots of psychological support. And he said, we'll just keep assessing your nerve function of your face. It will ultimately come back. Well, yeah, it would if it was Bell's palsy, but it wasn't, and it was a stroke, so it took a lot, yeah, much, much more. So this poor woman is 34 years old, and she just, the sweetest lady you ever want to meet. And the husband was so attentive and so terrified that something would happen to his wife. Scared to death. You could tell he adored her. Can they sue? Well, yeah, if you find the right attorney. Okay. All right, let's talk about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS. ALS is a degeneration of the motor neurons in the spinal cord, in the medulla, and in the cortex. It is progressive. Okay, so there's weakness and atrophy of the muscles of the extremities and of the trunk, so it kind of marches up. So essentially with ALS, your brain is intact, but what you're doing is you're actually watching your body just die on you. It's called Lou Gehrig's disease as well. Steve Hawkins, who is a professor of astrophysics at Harvard University, he has ALS. This is probably the most brilliant man since Albert Einstein. And he has written many, many books. Now, you say, how in the world can he write books? He can hardly talk. He's got a trach now. Okay? So how can he write books? Because he can't use his fingers to type. He blows. Okay? This is what happens. He has a special machine that's set up. And he's got this special straw-like contraption. Okay, that he puts, now it's in his trach, but it used to be in his mouth. He puts it in his mouth, and he actually points to the keyboard, okay, the letter, and he blows, and this is how he types. With yes. And he has written incredible books on astrophysics. Incredible books. What is the treatment for ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis? Well, you know there's an airway problem, because the problem is in the medulla. Okay, you've got the brain itself, the cortex is fine, but the medulla oblongata, which is where your respiratory center is, there's a problem there. So because there's a problem with the airway, you know, you have to be, with the breathing, you have to be very careful about airway with this particular guy. Okay. Another thing is, remember, he's going to ultimately become completely immobilized, and that's Steve Hawkins. He sits in this special wheelchair. He needs special help. He cannot do anything on his own. Multiple sclerosis is the next one. Now, we've got to know the difference between multiple sclerosis and myasthenia gravis. I know everybody confuses this. So let's try to explain it real clearly. Multiple sclerosis is when you have nerve demyelination in the brain and spinal cord. Now, do you all remember, if you don't, I'm going to refresh your mind right now. Do you all remember the structure of a nerve? Yes? The structure of a nerve is such that forget this eye here. You've got the body, the cell body here, right? And the dendrites. And then you've got the axon. Yes? Right? And you know that this axon has the myelin sheath around it, don't you? Yes? And you know that the myelin sheath is not one continuous sheath, but it's sort of like this. And in between, and there are little spaces here and here and here and here and here, right? And these are called your nodes of Ranvier. Now, you also know that when an impulse is conducted, it has to go, it's conducted, does these saltatory leaps, right, over the myelin sheaths to get to the cell body. If we didn't have any myelin sheath, now, okay, all of you, if you slam your hand on the desk, you feel it right away, right? If you didn't have a myelin sheath, it would take you 5 days to feel that. True, because that's how slow the impulse would be conducted without the myelin sheath. So with the myelin sheath, we feel the impulse immediately. Without it, 5 days later, oh, I think I hit my hand. So now if you think about that, and you think about people with multiple sclerosis, there's a demyelination. In other words, the myelin sheath dies, disappears, goes away. Okay? So if you think about that, then you think about how slow their responses are. Yes? And you can also think about when you're standing, is your body firing? Are there any nerve firings occurring as you're standing? Absolutely. Absolutely. When you're sleeping, are there any nerve firings occurring? Absolutely. Because it's not just to move and do something that your body fires, okay, or does any kind of conduction of neurological activity. You need constant neurological activity to even maintain muscle tone while you're sleeping. Okay, muscle tone while you're sitting or standing and not doing anything. So if you think about these people with multiple sclerosis that don't have the myelin on the sheath, they have trouble just keeping their eyes open. And so they've got diplopia. They have difficulty looking at things. Everything slows down. They have tremors. Why? Because they cannot control the fluid movement of their hands. They have weakness and numbness, again, because there's lack of control. The ataxic gait is because they can't. There's no synapse from the brain to the feet to say, pick your feet up and walk. The synapsing is extremely slow. They want to do it, but they can't. Nystagmus occurs, and what's that? That, again, you know, is that eyeball fluttering around on you. They've got bladder problems as well. They have difficulty controlling their bladder. What's the treatment? Steroids, remember? We give ACTH as well, adrenocorticotropic hormone. We give psychological support, and obviously we want to prevent complications of immobility. So do you understand now about multiple sclerosis? Okay, let's talk about myasthenia gravis, the difference. They're both neurological problems, but myasthenia gravis, the myelin sheath is intact. You don't have a problem with that. What you do have a problem with is the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. In your whole body, you've got neurotransmitters. You've got acetylcholine, you've got norepinephrine, you've got serotonin, you've got dopamine, you've got all these different neurotransmitters, right? But the neurotransmitter that is the most abundant is acetylcholine. Now, you all know also that when an impulse is sent, down to the cell body, okay, when you get to the body's not just one long nerve, right? Not one long neuron. There are multiple neurons. So in order, see, this is a neuron. In order for this impulse. In order for this impulse to cross this gap, to get over to this other nerve, the other nerve, right? I need a bridge or a boat, and that bridge or boat is my acetylcholine, my neurotransmitter. If I don't have it, I can't cross. So I'm going to be stuck right here. That's the situation with myasthenia gravis. You don't have enough acetylcholine. So the impulse that's generated gets stuck. Can't move. This is where I'm going to stay. Now, when that happens, what do you have? The body cannot, the brain cannot continue to keep the body with muscle tone. Remember, I said, when you're sleeping, you're firing. When you're sitting, you're firing. Okay? You're constantly doing some kind of neurological firing. If you don't have that acetylcholine where the brain can send a message to your muscle to stay strong, you will have muscle weakness. Does that make sense? Yeah, sure it does. You have ptosis, and what's that? You have that droopy one eye, yes? You've got shortness of breath. You've got dysphagia. Now, what is the definitive test for myasthenia gravis? It's called Tensilon. And if any one of you has ever seen the Tensilon test, it's pretty impressive. We give it IV over about 5 minutes, and the resolution of the symptoms occurs immediately. It lasts the maximum, though, only 15 minutes. It goes away, and this Tensilon can never be used again. It will never work again. It can only work one time. Because people always say, well, gee, if Tensilon resolves the symptoms of myasthenia gravis, then why don't we use it as a cure? Because it only works one time. That's it. So the definitive test for myasthenia gravis is the Tensilon test. What is the treatment for myasthenia gravis? It's a skunk of a treatment, folks. And that's why I put my skunk up there. You can give prostigmine and mestinon, but you've got to tell the difference between a cholinergic and a myasthenic crisis. A cholinergic is when you have an overproduction, okay, of acetylcholine, but you don't have enough receptors. Whereas a myasthenic crisis is you don't have enough acetylcholine, but you got plenty of receptors. Okay, so how do you treat it? Good question. So you got to be able to differentiate between the two. If you're going to give medications, the prostigmine, you want to give it 30 minutes before you eat. Good nutrition is extremely, extremely important as well. On to Parkinson's. Parkinson's is the old person's disease. That's what everyone says until Michael J. Fox came out and told everybody that he also has Parkinson's at a very early age. With Parkinson's, you have a situation where you have a decreased amount of dopamine. Dopamine is also a neurotransmitter, but dopamine lives only in your brain. It does not live anywhere else. It cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. Okay. Because people say, well, gee, if you know what it is, why don't you just give him dopamine? That's fine. All the dopamine will be sitting right here in your stomach and the rest of your body. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. It will not go into the brain. However, levodopa does. So that's why we give Sinemet, because it's levodopa-carbidopa, right? Levodopa and carbidopa does cross the blood-brain barrier. So that's why we give that. That crosses into the brain, and it converts to dopamine. So with Parkinson's, it's a decrease in the neurotransmitter of dopamine in your brain. You find striatal degeneration with Parkinson's, and you have what we call resting tremors. Have you ever seen those people with Parkinson's? They're sitting down, they've got their hand on their lap, and all of a sudden their hand starts going. Okay, resting tremors. There's also a situation called intentional tremors, and that is when they reach for something to pick up something and the hand just starts shaking. Okay. That's intentional tremors. Resting tremors is when they sit and they start to tremor. People with Parkinson's have a shuffling gait. They also have mask-like facies. You know, they always look like they're surprised. Okay? They almost have a look of tardive dyskinesia. Remember in psychiatry, you learned that some drugs cause the freezing of the face, tardive dyskinesia. Well, Parkinson's, you'll also see that. You'll also see that they don't blink quite so much. Their eye, that's that mask, like the surprised look all the time. So because they don't blink a whole heck of a lot, their eyeballs dry out. So with Parkinson's, it's very important to do the eye drops to the eyes. Very, very important. Okay? And you will see with Parkinson's that a lot of people will be prescribed Benadryl. Now why, geez, why Benadryl? It's not to go to sleep. But Benadryl actually decreases the side effects of the carbidopa-levodopa. So that's why we give Benadryl with Parkinson's. What's the treatment? Like I said, Sinemet, Artane, all these drugs, right, that cross the blood-brain barrier that can be converted to dopamine. Now remember, it's not the purest form of dopamine, but at least it's something that it gets converted to. People with Parkinson's, you need to make sure that when you give them posture support at all times. If they're sitting in a chair, you can't put them in a chair like this because they'll fall over. You got to put them in a chair with armchairs. When they're sleeping at night, take the pillow away. Because they'll sleep, they'll put their head on the pillow and the chin will drop like this and they can't move their head now. So they could actually suffocate. So pillow, no pillow, okay? Bed with no pillow. Slip-on shoes, don't be cruel. Don't give them those lace top things, okay? Velcro is okay, but the slip-on loafers are a whole lot better. And definitely small frequent meals and daily exercise. All right, next one is Guillain-Barré. Guillain-Barré is similar to multiple sclerosis because you've got patchy demyelination of the long peripheral nerves. Multiple sclerosis occurs on any nerves. Guillain-Barré occurs on the long peripheral nerves. It is temporary. It will go away. Your feeling will come back. That's the good news. So oftentimes when someone comes in, the symptomology is the same with Guillain-Barré, or at least the beginning symptomology is the same as multiple sclerosis. So they'll have to do diagnostic tests to make sure that it's not multiple sclerosis, because Guillain-Barré will resolve. Okay, with Guillain-Barré, you have paralysis of the lower extremities, which ascends. It does get better. They're very clumsy in their early phases, but they do get better. Okay, you want to maintain respiratory functions. You give the famous, ever famous steroids. And you've got to tell them that, again, you'll get better, but it may take several months. All right? Tic douloureux, also known as trigeminal neuralgia. And what cranial nerve is this? Five. Cranial nerve five disorder. Okay. There's a shooting pain to one side of the face, because it's very, very painful. And it can be triggered by extremely cold temperatures, by chewing, by twitching, or by grimacing. Okay, so you know how when you were younger, did your parents tell you don't make that face because the wind will change directions and your face will be stuck like that? Yeah, my grandmother, because I used to make all the worst faces in the world. And she would say to me, don't make that face. The wind's going to change directions and your face is going to get stuck like that. Okay, well, this is the tic douloureux thing. They grimaced, okay, they actually made a face, and then the cold wind blew, and it did get stuck like that. I mean, really, that's the history behind it. That's why the old wives' tale, don't make a face, the wind will change directions, and you get, yeah. So with tic douloureux, or trigeminal neuralgia, you're going to manage their pain. Well, we've got in the ER several patients who come in, and they're frequent flyers. I keep telling them we don't give miles, but they come in anyway. The frequent flyers, they come in for everything. You know, the bunion on the toe, you know, everything. And they want Demerol for the bunion on the toe. So they're constantly coming in for one problem after another. Well, we've got this one particular patient who is very creative. Very creative, because she wants her Percocet, buddy. Okay, she wants it. So she comes in. Every time she comes in, she's got a strange and new disease. And I mean, she must have a dictionary at home, a medical dictionary or something, because, man, she picks them. So she comes in now with tic douloureux, trigeminal neuralgia, shooting pain up one side of her face. And she wants her medicine, but she wants Demerol in the ER, and she wants a prescription for Percocet or Lorsets to go, please. Do you want French fries with that? So we say to her, oh, trigeminal neuralgia, well, we'll give you Tegretol. Because that's the treatment, Tegretol. And Tegretol is an anticonvulsive. She says, I don't have seizures. Ooh, you're good. You know your drugs. She goes, I don't have seizures. Well, that's the treatment, though, for trigeminal neuralgia is Tegretol. We'll also give Dilantin, another anti-seizure medication. And they work. We don't know why it works, but it works. And it works a heck of a lot better than Demerol. Sometimes if we're really nice, and depending on the ER doctor, she will or he will do an alcohol nerve block right there. And essentially what they'll do is they'll paralyze that particular nerve temporarily, okay, and get rid of the pain. And it works very nicely for some people. But certainly no Demerol and certainly no Percocet. And what we want to tell this person is you want to control your exposure to the cold. So control that. What's the treatment? Well, rhizotomy, a nose job. We can do a rhizotomy. a rhinotomy, actually, is a nose job. But a rhizotomy is when you go in and you actually just cut that nerve so they don't have any more episodes. And we offered that to her, but she said, no, I don't understand. We were willing to do it right in the ER, right there and then. She could have gone home, man, taking care of that problem right away. She didn't want to do it. Don't get it. We also want to tell her to avoid hot foods, and because, you know, it's one side, to chew only on the good side. The Glasgow Coma Scale. Well, the Glasgow Coma Scale monitors three things. It monitors eye-opening, verbal response, and best motor response. Those are the three things it monitors, and there is a total of 15 points that you can give. 15 points is good. Eye-opening, verbal response, best motor response. It does not monitor pupillary reaction. And that's an NCLEX question, where they tried to fool you and tell you, and offer pupillary reaction as a choice. The Glasgow Coma Scale does not monitor that. Maximum is 15. The higher the score, the better the neurological status. What are your interventions if the patient has a low Glasgow? Say the patient has a Glasgow Coma Scale of 2. What does that tell you? Tells you he's in bad shape, very bad shape. You're going to see something called mannitol being given, and mannitol is an osmotic diuretic that works very, very well on the brain. You will see a stool softener being given, okay, because you want to do what? Decrease intracranial pressure. Airway will be maintained because, remember, the increased pressure in your brain can push down on your medulla oblongata, and we know that that's where your respiratory center is, so that can cause problems with your breathing. Okay, you're also going to do neurochecks every 2 hours, and you're going to watch for the posturing, the decorticate versus the decerebrate posturing. Your job as a nurse to prevent complications of immobility. Your job also is to monitor intracranial pressure changes. If a person has a Glasgow Coma Scale of 2, he's going to have some kind of a monitor where they will actually be monitoring the intracranial pressure. Okay, so it's your job to tell the doctor when there are ICP changes. You're also going to watch for a possibility of meningitis, because remember, when they put that burr hole in and they put it right into the brain, okay, with the cerebrospinal fluid is so that they can monitor the pressure. That's a direct access also for any bacteria to get in. Okay? You've got to position the person properly. Range of motion is very, very important. You have no idea how many neurological patients I see in the neuro ICU that are all contracted up. Okay? You think they're decorticate posturing, but they're not. They're just contracted. So decorticate to cerebrate posturing. Decorticate indicates that you've got some corticospinal tract involvement. And decerebrate indicates the midbrain or pons involvement. Decorticate is worse because when you're talking about your corticospinal tract, you're talking about your higher levels of functioning. Okay? Decerebrate indicates your midbrain or your pons, which is your base level of functioning. So decorticate is worse. When they do a decorticate posturing, any kind of posturing, you really start talking to people about maybe a DNR. What's your treatment for intracranial pressure and increase in intracranial pressure? As I said, you'll see mannitol being given, you'll see burr holes being given, steroids. You want to avoid the Valsalva as well. Now remember that you're going to monitor anytime you have a patient with a brain problem, increased intracranial pressure, trauma to the brain, brain surgery, you're going to watch for signs of diabetes insipidus and SIADH, right? Okay. You may sometimes see brain surgery being done, intracranial surgery. Well, you've got the tentorium right here. If the incision is above the tentorium, then you want to make sure that the head of bed is elevated about 35 to 45 degrees, and it can be on one side or this side. You want to position the person on the unaffected side because you want to decrease intracranial pressure, right? And you're also going to check fluid and electrolytes. Why is that? Diabetes insipidus, and right? So that's the reason why you want to check it. If it's infratentorium, which means lower, then the head of bed can be a little bit lower or flat even. But you want to make sure that you don't put a pillow under his head, because if he flexes the head on the chest, guess what happens? He stretches the suture line, and you don't want to do that. Okay? NPO for at least 24 hours. yeah, well, you know, if he's got intracranial pressure, if he's got a low glass glaucoma scale, then you don't have to worry about the NPO because you won't be eating. But sometimes people do go in for brain surgery, like to remove a brain tumor or something like that. He needs to be NPO for 24 hours, and you've got to check respirations continuously. Oh, but one thing we want to talk about. We want to talk about spinal cord injury and autonomic dysreflexia. Would you say this guy might possibly have some spinal cord injury after she's done with him? Spinal cord injury is a complete or partial disruption of the nerve tracts and the neurons. Okay, so how do you know how far along, or how dangerous the spinal cord injury is? Well, essentially, the higher the insult, the worse the injury. So at C4 and above, you know that his respiratory status is going to be affected. Okay, you've got to check for color motion sensitivity on all your patients. In your handout, in your book, there are all the different levels of injury. So the lower the level, okay, the less involvement, the higher the level, the more the involvement. Spinal shock may occur. And with spinal shock, you have low blood pressure and low heart rate as well. And something called autonomic dysreflexia can occur as well. And autonomic dysreflexia is a condition that occurs with spinal cord injury where you suddenly get a very, very high blood pressure. Okay. Below the lesion or below the level of the insult, there's no sweating. Above the level of the insult, there's profuse sweating. What we hate as ER nurses is when we get an in-code from EMS that says this person was in a multi-vehicle accident. Okay, we're bringing him in, and he has priapism. And what does that mean? It means he has an erection. If he's got an erection, we all go, oh, no. Because that means that his blood pressure is probably sky high, and he's got autonomic dysreflexia. It means we have to somehow deflate that penis real quick, put a Foley in him, okay, and drain the bladder, because the triggers to autonomic dysreflexia ordinarily are a neurogenic bowel. It can be a full bowel or a full bladder. Okay, and men, when they have a full bladder, they also tend to get an erection as well. Just so you know that, because there is an NCLEX question that has to do with autonomic dysreflexia. And it says, what should you do? This person is a spinal cord patient. Actually, the question is, which of the following patients should you see first? One of them is a diabetic, and he's got a blood sugar. Yesterday it was 240, today it's 260. Another one is a patient with a blood pressure of 140 over 80. Another one is a cystic fibrosis patient who's taking his medications, and who's run out and needs some more. And the fourth one is a spinal cord patient who is complaining of constipation for 3 days. And your answer is you go see the spinal cord patient with constipation, because that full bladder can certainly trigger autonomic dysreflexia, which is lethal, potentially lethal. Our very last subject of the day is CVA. A CVA is a brain attack, and essentially it's an interruption of the blood flow to the brain for 5 minutes or more. It can be ischemic, from a thrombus, or it can be hemorrhagic. Now, you all have heard about TIAs, haven't you? Transient ischemic attacks. And transient ischemic attacks are early signs and symptoms. They're what we call mini strokes. I had a patient once in the Bahamas. Yes, I did work. I worked in the Bahamas. I have worked in Santo Domingo. I have worked in Brazil. I have worked in the craziest places you ever want to know of. But I was in the Bahamas, and I was, trying to have a good time. And it really was a failure, because here's this little old man who was sitting and talking to me, and in the middle of his sentence, he kind of dropped off, and his whole face fell to one side, and he just stopped talking for about 3 to 4 minutes, and then all of a sudden, all this resolved, and he continued talking. Where am I? He said. And I went, I really hate that when this happens. I'm really trying to enjoy my pina colada here, and now he has to have a TIA right in front of me. The bottom line is that we ended up having to get a medevac plane in, and we transported him back to Miami, and, we got him into Jackson Memorial, and we got him into the hospital. But certainly one of the signs and symptoms of TIA, the confusion, the sudden loss, Okay? The other thing also that you might find with TIAs is though this side of the face, see the left side of the face droops? The left side of the face droops, but it is the right side of the body that you're going to see any kind of sequela, because remember the cranial nerves cross, right, at the foramen magnum. So that's what happened with this particular guy also. The left side of the face drooped, the right side of the arm ended up with some kind of consequence, sequela. How do you control, how do you treat CVAs? The number one risk factor for CVA is what? High blood pressure, uncontrolled high blood pressure. So you want to make sure that they're taking their medications. Yes, I have a patient who comes in who has high blood pressure, and I'm talking high blood pressure. And he says that he doesn't want to take his medicines because they don't work. Okay? I said, humor me, take them for a week, and then come back. So I said to his wife, make sure he takes it for a week, and I don't care how you threaten him, but make sure he takes it for a week. He did. Well, when I saw him the first time, his blood pressure was 180 over 140. Okay, when he came back a week later, he said, they don't work. Well, I took his blood pressure, and guess what? His blood pressure was 140 over 90. Did they work? You bet. But you know what he tells me? That's still high. That's still a high blood pressure because somebody had told him 90 is high. So you see, it doesn't work. And I went, you know, 180 over 140 to 140 over, I think it works. Come to find out, the main reason he didn't want to take it, impotence. So wife is saying, you know, sex isn't everything, honey. I'd rather have you alive. CVAs, controlled, you're the high blood pressure, okay? You'll see anticoagulants being given because you want to thin out the blood. The sooner you start the rehab, the faster the person will actually get better and the less sequelae you will see. You want to tell the patient to chew on the unaffected side, okay? And remember that if the patient has receptive aphasia, in other words, he cannot understand what you're saying, then you have to give simple, nonverbal instructions. If he has expressive aphasia, in other words, he understands everything you say, but he cannot tell you what he needs, then you need to anticipate his needs. An example would be, here's a patient with expressive aphasia. You know that when you wake up in the morning, what's the first thing you do? Go to the bathroom, right? So first thing in the morning, you take him, you go to the bathroom. And then you anticipate his needs by making sure his toothbrush is ready, his comb is ready. You anticipate all this stuff because this is what he does at home. You know, and he gets changed and everything. Anticipate his needs. And then every 2 hours or so, say, do you need to go to the bathroom? Or let's go to the bathroom. Okay, and that's, again, anticipatory guidance, and that's something that NCLEX just loves to question you on. A patient who has a CVA is temporarily and sometimes permanently immobilized, depending on the extent of the CVA and how fast we rehabbed him. So you're going to see something called hypostatic pneumonia occurring, and that essentially is he's immobile, he doesn't move, and so he can actually get pneumonia from not moving. He's also at risk for decubitus ulcers, he's at risk for constipation, for contractions, and he's also at risk for kidney stones, again, because of the immobility, he's just not moving. Okay, so he's at risk for a lot. Now, what does this say, anybody? It says mahalo, your pau, which means mahalo is thank you in Hawaiian, and your pau means you're done.
You have completed the medical surgical section. Please move to the next section of the lecture series, which is women's health and maternal newborn nursing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and leave a rating. We wish you all the best in the coming examination. See you next time.